Good evening, Arizona, ascertains the election. The Supreme Court hears an attempt by the Trump administration to count out undocumented immigrants in the United States from the discussions on the size of electoral districts and the size of congressional districts in each state. And we talk about the attempt by different foreign powers to murder scientists of other countries involved in nuclear and other weapons technologies. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo, and this is the WBAI News for Monday, November 30th, 2020.
Arizona officials certified Joe Biden's narrow victory over President Donald Trump in the state earlier today.
This signed and sealed document now constitutes the official canvass results of the November 3rd, 2020 general election. Based on the official canvass, my office and the governor's office have also prepared the certificates of ascertainment for presidential electors, the certificate of election for U.S. Senator, and the proclamation by the governor declaring the ballot measures approved by the voters. And we will now sign each of those documents. All right, well, this concludes the official canvass of the November 3rd, 2020 general election.
Republican Governor Doug Ducey insisted on the integrity of the election, even as lawyers for Trump were across town Monday, arguing without evidence before a Republican group that the election was marred by fraud. Biden won Arizona by 0.3% of the nearly 3.4 million ballots cast, a margin of just under 10,500 votes. He's the second Democrat in 70 years to win the state. Meanwhile, in Washington, the United States Supreme Court was holding a hearing on Trump's attempt to exclude undocumented immigrants from being counted. It's part of the apportionment process, divvying up congressional seats between the states. Trump doesn't want to count undocumented persons, a sharp detour from centuries of practice in the United States. ACLU lawyer Dale Ho argued the case.
The administration is ending as it began, with yet another attack on immigrant communities. It was almost 4 years ago that the administration began with the Muslim ban. It ends with its second attempt to weaponize the census against immigrant communities. And not just do that, but to attack voting rights by tilting the electoral playing field for the next decade, not just in terms of the distribution of seats in Congress, but also distorting the Electoral College. Three courts have held that this policy is illegal, unanimously, including judges appointed by both Democratic and Republican presidents. Our hope is that the Supreme Court will do so as well.
Several states, led by New York and immigrant rights groups, want the court to affirm a lower court decision and block the White House proposal. New York State Attorney General Letitia James.
This is nothing more than an attempt to strip immigrant-rich states like New York out of representation. The simple truth is that no one ceases to be a person because they lack documentation, or ceases to live here because the president would prefer them to leave. And that's why we filed this lawsuit in July and numerous others like it before. My office has taken up the fight every single step of the way to challenge and block every swing the Trump administration has taken to obstruct a fair count and a lawful apportionment. And we will continue to do whatever is necessary to stop the president from putting politics above the law or unlawfully tipping the balance of power in the nation, and that includes post-reapportionment litigation. As for these arguments, President Trump's repeated attempts to hinder, impair, and prejudice an accurate census and the subsequent apportionment have repeatedly failed, and we have all the confidence that his illegal actions will fail once again. After all, everyone counts, and therefore everyone must be counted.
New York State Attorney General Letitia James. The justices seem to agree the suit should be postponed until the end of the year when the apportionment count is due to see if Trump follows through on excluding undocumented persons. Chief Justice John Roberts asked whether the court should wait. He said that as things stand now, we don't know what the president is going to do. We don't know how many aliens will be excluded. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, Trump's third Supreme Court nominee, seemed to agree. Doesn't that cut in favor of waiting, she asked. Meanwhile, the Trump administration says it wants to use census data without identifying the counted person to get more accurate counts of undocumented people residing in the United States. The ACLU's Dale Ho says there doesn't seem like reason to panic for now.
The government for a year and a half, dating back to July of 2019, has been saying that it's going to try to match administrative records, that is, records from agencies like the Social Security Administration, the Department of Homeland Security, even state driver's license records from state DMVs, to the extent that those are being shared with the administration, to census responses to try to calculate the number of citizens, non-citizens, and apparently undocumented immigrants living in each state. So we've known about this for about a year and a half. I want to be clear that that is not a violation of people's confidentiality. They're not planning on sharing people's census responses with anyone else. What the Census Bureau is doing is it's taking in additional information and matching that information up in an anonymized way so that we can have these statistics about the number of people with different kinds of status. But the government and the Census Bureau remain under very, very, very strict confidentiality requirements, so that information can't be shared on an individual basis outside of the Census Bureau. So I want to make sure that people understand that their information that they've given to the Census Bureau is still protected by law. And we don't have any reason to believe that, as lawless as this administration is, that they're violating that particular practice.
And President-elect Joe Biden is making the first formal preparations for his January 20th inauguration. He's unveiling the inaugural committee leading arrangements for the day he and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris assume their posts. In a statement Monday, the inaugural committee says it'll work on keeping people safe and preventing the spread of COVID-19 while engaging all Americans in the festivities. Also today, Biden announced his senior economic team. Biden said he would nominate Janet Yellen, the former Federal Reserve Chair, to lead the Treasury Department, the first woman in the job. The president-elect also announced former Clinton and Obama advisor Neera Tanden will be director of the Office of Management and Budget. Some progressives in the Democratic Party are unhappy with the choice of Tanden, who during her tenure as president of the Liberal Center for American Progress presided over the censorship of a report criticizing then-Mayor Michael Bloomberg and NYPD for violating the rights of Muslim New Yorkers. Freelance journalist Zaid Jilani worked for the Center for American Progress, where he says he saw Tanden's abrasive management style firsthand, but isn't surprised she got the job.
No, I don't think you should be shocked at all. I very much expected Neera to get some kind of position in the Democratic administration. I think it's a little unusual, though, that she's being placed in a position that usually requires much more management expertise and also policy expertise, because I see her more as a political operator or
right.
a campaign person.
Well, what does that mean? Is that a problem? Like, is she going to is that a problem? Is she going to go around and smash down liberals and root out Bernie Sanders supporters?
I mean, I'll say this, like when I worked with her at CAP, she had a poor relationship with a ton of people there, but like not just me, but like a lot of people. And I think it's just managing in a complex political environment is a certain skill that you have to have. And I think she maybe will have a little bit more of a challenge of that if she's confirmed. She doesn't take disagreement very well, and she's a very my way or the highway type person. And, you know, when you're overseeing 500 plus employees, it may be a problem. I don't necessarily think she'll go out, as you said, smash liberals. I don't think it's an ideological thing for her. I don't think it's more of a you need to align with where the powers to be are, where the powers to be are right now. Like, you need to align with whoever her boss, whoever she feels she has to report to at the time. And who knows who that'll be? Who knows how politics will change in the country over the next few years if she's confirmed? But it could potentially be a problem, because the reality is that when you fill a government with people who are more political operators, who are more career, their minds are more on larger career political goals or recurring favor and that kind of stuff, it can be a problem. I think we saw that over the past 4 years.
Did she hit somebody?
She did. She did hit, actually, my former boss, Baz Shakir, who worked with me at CAP at that point, but he also was Bernie Sanders' campaign manager in the most recent campaign. She hit him, and Hillary Clinton came to CAP. She wasn't the president there at the time. She was working for Hillary. Baz asked her a question about Iraq, and then Neera punched him because she was angry. She didn't want him to ask Hillary a tough question. That's what I'm saying.
Like, I punched him hard, or in a friendly punch, or like get hard, a painful punch.
The way the New York Times reported it was that it was a punch, but she says it was a shove, But it was an angry, shove. Like she, it wasn't a friendly thing.
You don't mess around on her ship.
That's the thing. Can somebody like that manage 500 plus government bureaucrats who are often going to tell her news she doesn't want to hear? Maybe she'll tell, they'll tell her something unflattering about Joe Biden, Joe Biden's budget proposal or something. Is she going to just respond that way? She has a reputation for being that way with people she works with, is what I would say. And that can be a problem in an office like this.
Freelance journalist Saeed Jelani worked for the Center for American Progress. Glenn Greenwald wrote Neera Tanden was key to blaming Russian hackers for Trump's victory in 2016. Emails leaked to Greenwald in 2015 apparently revealed attempts by Tanden to censor criticism of Israel. Following the Libya intervention, Tanden argued that having oil-rich countries partly pay us back doesn't seem crazy to me. Greenwald wrote that Tanden meant Libyans should be forced to turn over large portions of their oil revenues to repay the U.S. for the costs incurred in bombing Libya. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. A senior Iranian security official has accused Israel of using electronic devices to carry out a remote assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist. The secretary of the country's Supreme National Security Council made his comments at the funeral for Moshe Fakhrizadeh. The Fars news agency reported the attack involved the use of a remote-controlled weapon mounted on a car. It said no attackers were present at the time of the assassination. The Iranian state-owned broadcaster Press TV cited identified informed sources as saying remnants from the attack showed Israeli arms have been used to kill Fakhrizadeh. Israel has not claimed responsibility or officially commented on the attack. During the past decade, Iran has accused Israel of killing at least five of its nuclear scientists. Fakhrizadeh is considered the most senior and high profile. Western and Israeli intelligence services had described him for years as the leader of a covert atomic bomb program halted in 2003. A senior fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University is William Toby. He says targeting nuclear scientists has a long history going as far back as the Nazi physics chief Werner Heisenberg.
There were a group of German rocket scientists who were working for Egypt in the 50s and 60s. They were targeted. There was an individual named Gerald Bull who was working on a long-range cannon for Iraq, again, seems to have been targeted. And then there was a spate of killings in Iran early last decade. But, of course, this last incident was the most spectacular of them.
What's the general effect of targeting the scientists on both sides? And again, I just can point out to movies, and I know in the movie War Games, the nuclear scientist who retires because he doesn't want to do it anymore has to live on an island.
The real effects are likely to be limited. Any country that is large and sophisticated enough to mount a successful nuclear weapons effort can probably afford to hire more than a few key individuals. And while it may slow progress for a time, and sometimes slowing progress can be important, it's unlikely to effectively end a nuclear weapons program.
Then why do it?
It's a very good question. And trying to puzzle out those ideas, it might be that there was a judgment that slowing is particularly important now. It could be that whoever undertook this had sensed that the Iranian program was at an inflection point. You may also know that there were mysterious fires and explosions at an Iranian nuclear facility at Natanz over the summer. So clearly there had been some feeling that whatever was going on within the Iranian program seemed to pose more of a threat now than it had earlier. It can deter the participation of others in a program. And then finally, it might be a message that, look, you may have ambitions to pursue nuclear weapons, but we know where your facilities are, we know where your people are, and you're never going to get there. And that could actually deter Iran from moving forward.
Iran has not really been pursuing a nuclear weapon. Not seriously, anyway.
Several of my colleagues and I spent some time examining the nuclear archive that had been spirited out of Iran that documents a determined nuclear weapons effort that seems to have ended in 2003, although, and it was headed by Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the person who reportedly has been killed. He was sanctioned by the Obama government, by the Obama administration in 2015 for being part of an organization that was pursuing a nuclear weapon. So while the Ahmed project was shut down, he moved to an organization that went by the acronym SPND. And no one quite knows what that activity involved, and Iran has refused to allow the International Atomic Energy Agency access to him.
In history, with Heisenberg, the famous catcher, Mo Berg, involved in an attempt at assassination.
Yes.
What happened with that for the baseball fans?
So, yeah, it's quite a story. He was a guy who was extremely talented. I guess Casey Stengel said of him once that he spoke five languages but couldn't hit in any of them. But he volunteered for the OSS, which was a predecessor or precursor to the CIA, was eventually sent on a mission to Switzerland at the end of 1944, early 1945, to go and hear Werner Heisenberg speak. The Battle of the Bulge was raging at the time. He went to see Heisenberg and listened to him speak about solar flares having nothing to do with nuclear weapons. So, and he attended the lecture with a pistol in his pocket and orders to kill Heisenberg if he said anything at all about pursuing a nuclear weapons program. Heisenberg, of course, did not. Berg later went to a party with him where Heisenberg lamented that the Battle of the Bulge had turned against the Nazis, therefore they would lose the war. Berg took that as evidence that they didn't have a nuclear weapons program and walked out of the room and left Heisenberg alone.
Say it ain't so, Mo. William Tobey, senior fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard. Werner Karl Heisenberg was a German theoretical physicist and one of the key pioneers of quantum mechanics and a supporter of Nazi Germany. And finally, in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo warned of a possible return to more robust COVID-19 restrictions on Monday as the number of hospitalizations begins to rise to levels not seen since early June. The number of people statewide hospitalized with COVID-19 is now above 3,500, nearly quadrupling in the past 5 months. Cuomo held a news conference on Monday.
Now, the mindset for the holiday season, all right, we're now all happy and cheery and we're going to come together. And we're doing gift buying, and we're going to do holiday celebrations. We're going to start to have meals together. The family's coming back together for the holiday season. Students are all coming home. Religious celebrations during the holiday season. Yeah, COVID is the Grinch. Think of it that way. And the COVID Grinch is an opportunist. And the COVID Grinch sees this as the season of viral transmission. All those things that the holiday season brings, they all increase social activity, they all increase mobility, and they will all increase viral transmission. So this is the season of the COVID Grinch also. When you hear that holiday music, Marcia, think.
Sing it again.
Dun, 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 dun. Think COVID Grinch and be on alert because that is part of this holiday season.
Similar to what occurred in the spring, all hospitals must plan to add 50% capacity. According to Cuomo, some hospitals are already reporting staff shortages, even as the problem gets better in schools and nursing homes.
The school protocols and the school testings, great, highly effective. Astonishing how low the levels of infections are in schools, especially K-8. Really bad news, family gatherings and smaller social gatherings have exploded as places where the virus is spreading. So we understand the cause, we understand the effect. And we understand the effect is dramatic. And this is the bottom line on all of this. COVID rates go up. When the COVID rates go up, what happens? The hospitalization rate goes up. And the hospitalization rate is increasing dramatically. End of June, we're about 900. We're now at 3,500, okay? Since the end of June. And that is before feeling the effect of the holiday season.
And the governor had a friendly encounter with New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, despite reports of conflict in the relationship between the two men.
Let's go to Mayor Bill de Blasio. I know he didn't get a chance to enjoy Thanksgiving because I kept interrupting. But he was very good at speaking with a mouthful of turkey. He was very good at doing that, continuing to eat but do business at the same time. I respect that.
You know? It's you got to enjoy it when you can, right? But Governor, thank you. I thought the conversations this weekend were really helpful, and I appreciate the plan you've laid out. We learned a lot of lessons from the spring. We're applying them successfully here in New York City. And you're right, we got a couple of tough months ahead, but you know, there's a better day coming. But everyone needs to be part of the solution in the meantime, and that's what we're going to keep doing here in New York City. Thank you.
Governor Andrew Cuomo and Mayor Bill de Blasio.
And that's some of the news for Monday, November 30th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo, reporting from New York City. Thanks for joining us. Have a great evening.